Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 140 for April 12th, 2008. This time around, I'm in Lexington, Kentucky at DeShays Restaurant and Bar. Whiskey Magazine voted DeShays the best whiskey bar in the U.S., and at the worldwide competition in February, it came in a three-way tie for best whiskey bar in the world. The other good point, it's about a little more than an hour from Whiskey Magazine's choice this year as the visitor attraction of the year, the Maker's Mark Distillery in Loretto, Kentucky. More in a few minutes, but first, let's check the news. Last year, Glenmorangie revamped its entire line of single malts, almost. Now the successor to the Artisan Cask is about to be released. It's called Glenmorangie Astar, and while it's still in the final prototype stages, fellow malt maniac Ho Cheng Yao was able to taste it this week and shared some of the details. Astar will be a no-age statement single malt bottled at around 57% alcohol by volume. Ho Cheng says it's heavier and richer than the current Artisan Cask, and will probably cost about double the price of the current version. I'll have more details on release plans as soon as they're available. Meanwhile, Glenmorangie is losing one of the 16 men of Tane. Distillery manager Graham Junson is leaving after 12 years to take on the task of reviving Glenglassaugh. Before that, Graham worked at Glendronach and Scampa distilleries. Ian Buxton is also joining the Glenglassaugh team as interim marketing director, and he's continuing his work with the Classic Expressions series of historic whiskey books. For more on the Glenglassaugh revival, check the archives for episode 135 from last month, and an interview with managing director Stuart Nickerson. On the legal front, the battle between the Scotch Whiskey Association and Canada's Glenora distillers took another turn this past week. Canada's federal court overturned a trademark agency ruling last year that allowed Glenora to call its whiskey Glenbreton. The SWA appealed the ruling with evidence that some Canadians were confusing Glenbreton with Scotch whiskey, including listings on bar menus that had Glenbreton listed with single malt scotches. The association opposes use of the word Glen on any whiskey produced outside Scotland. Glenora executives plan to appeal the ruling to the Federal Court of Appeal. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The legendary Whiskey Fair in Limburg, Germany is April 26th and 27th. Whiskey Live is April 28th in Strasbourg, France. The Spirit of Speyside Festival runs from May 1st through the 5th in Dufton. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter holds tasting dinners in Denver on May 1st and New York City May 9th. The Spirit of Toronto Festival is May 10th. The 5th edition of Whiskey and All That is May 17th in Ayr, Scotland. And the Kieler Whiskey Fair is May 17th and 18th in Kiel, Germany. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at laphroaig.com. Loretto, Kentucky is the kind of town you really have to try hard to find. It's a little more than an hour southwest of Lexington, about an hour south of Louisville, and every year about 60 to 70,000 people make the trip to Loretto to visit the Maker's Mark Distillery. It's actually the oldest continuously operating distillery in the U.S., going back to the mid-1800s. But in 1953, William Samuels Sr. bought the distillery to produce his new bourbon. The first bottle of Maker's Mark was filled on May 3, 1953. The distillery opened its new visitor's center last year, and Whiskey Magazine named it the visitor attraction of the year in this year's Icons of Whiskey Awards. I toured the visitor's center and distillery the other day with Rob Samuels, the grandson of William Samuels Sr., and the latest generation of the Samuels family to get into the whiskey business, and assistant master distiller Kevin Smith.
Mark, this is interesting. What I find is that in our industry we have a lot of great stories. A lot of folks can talk about the heritage, but we actually are living in the time of the heritage where we have the grandson, we have the son, you know, the father, the one that actually created Maker's Mark has passed away, but we have all the photos that a lot of folks have, the one photo of the man, a sketch of the man back from the 1800s, where we are living and have the pictures and can see the evolution of his thinking as the brand became a real thing. And it's just, you're kind of feel more like living the history, you're in the history, and it's not something that you just read about or hear about.
And a lot went into really creating the new visitor center that has won you guys a lot of awards.
It has won us quite a few awards, and we're really thankful for all that support. I will say that the idea was to try and bring more information to drive home what Mr. Samuels was trying to create. And this reproduction of the house that they grew up in, where the bread was baked to discover the recipe, where the wax pot was to dip, and just that sense of heritage that you get when you're in here starts to unfold the brand and the history as you then enter into the tour to see actually what got created from that inspiration.
Tell me what's in this room.
This room has got a collection of pictures, a memorabilia, if you will, from the family. These are real photos that were given to us by the Samuels family to put in here. It has pictures of the old distillery, both the T.W. Samuels, where the family came from, and the Maker's Mark distillery back when it was known as the Burke's Mill. You have some interactive, really, I don't want to tip it off too much, but I'll just say a Harry Potter-esque area where some things come to life, and I'll leave it at that. And then you've got some more detail of the traditional heritage, where you see the lineage of the family. To me, it's got that home comfort feel. You got the smell of fresh bread baking. There's just a place to come and actually sit and relax and explore. And we're actually encouraging people to open things up, look through the blueprints, read the manuscripts, look at the there's family wedding albums, photo albums, things that you would see more personal. And we're encouraging people to take a look at all that, so to really make you feel like you're part of the brand.
Is my game. I understand you're the purveyor of what some are calling Kentucky champagne.
Yes.
Well, how would you like your Maker's Mark to be on the lips of every single person in the United States?
Well,
of course you would. Think big picture, Mr. Samuels. I'm talking about painting the Maker's Mark brand on barns, skywriting, ads in Life magazine, gigantic inflatable balloons in the Macy's Parade. The works!
Listen,
No, sir, you listen to the sound of millions of people sipping your fine whiskey after a long day's work. Can you hear it? I can.
Whiskey River runs between the visitor's center and the distillery. It's not the water source for Maker's Mark. That's a 60-million-acre spring-fed lake nearby. And even though the distillery is an industrial plant, it looks more like a farm than a factory. The noise inside the distillery makes it difficult to talk inside, let alone do an interview. But just outside the doors, Kevin's able to explain what makes the process inside unique.
The difference, while still being a bourbon, is the fact that we'll use wheat, where other distilleries use rye. We'll cook and ferment in smaller batches, the smallest batch size in the industry. The yeast that we use is unique to Maker's Mark. It's actually some of the mystery of Maker's Mark. It's two wild strains and the Samuel strain, and it's going to give a very unique flavor. And then the way we distill at the lower proofs and double distill, using 120, 60% alcohol by volume, and then the final distillation in a pot still doubler that is 130 proof or 65% alcohol by volume to create the actual flavor, keep all those grain flavors in that you lose with the higher distillations, keep all those great full-bodied fusel oil alcohol, great flavors in there created by the yeast that you lose with the higher distillations. So whether you're looking at the yeast or you're looking at the fermentation, if you're looking at the distillation, they're all pieces of the puzzle that create a very unique picture, create a very different flavor, create that flavor Mr. Samuels wanted to have, which was out on the front of the tongue, which makes us very unique from all the other bourbons.
After the barrels are filled, they spend about 6 years on average in warehouses around central Kentucky, where the summers are hot and the winters are cold. Over those 6 years, the barrels will start at the top of the warehouse and be rotated down to the bottom.
This is a very unique rotation right out of the barrel. Because, see, we don't do a single barrel. What we do is we'll do several barrels together, mingling, 150 barrels.
And when they're ready, barrels are dumped in batches of 150 and go to the bottling hall.
A lot of folks ask us, okay, where do you do all your stuff? Because obviously you don't do it all right here. The answer is no, we do it all here. And you're about ready to see our bottling facility. And as we go into the bottling hall, I want you to appreciate that this is an operation that's tied to a couple things. Efficiency isn't necessarily one of them. Or, as a matter of fact, we're inefficient, but by choice, by design. That's because every bottle in here, the way Mrs. Samuels decided to create the package and what she had to convince Mr. Samuels to do was to dip these bottles. Every bottle will be dipped by hand. Now, because of that, we run slower than most distilleries. The front line that you're going to see today running, I think it's running liters, is actually running somewhere around 90 bottles, 89, 90 bottles a minute. Top speed's 120. The second line behind it runs the other sizes in addition to the liters, and it runs closer to about 60 bottles a minute. Regular bottling hall was going to run somewhere around 400, 800, and if you talk brewing, bottles go so fast you need a strobe light to see it. Why am I telling you all this? Well, I want you to know that efficiencies are critical. We've got to run an operation, but not at the sacrifice of the quality of our package. All right. One rule as we walk in, if it's moving, don't touch it because there's machinery parts in here. But I will let you interact a little bit today. So I want you to kind of get a feel for what it's like to be in the bottling hall. Brandy-esque bottle. You look at the shape of that bottle, it doesn't look like a traditional whiskey bottle. Traditional whiskey bottles are round, they're tall, think of the scotch bottles. So this was a little bit more like a cognac squatty bottle. It's actually from that thought standpoint where the wax comes from, too.
After that, it's time for the final touch, dipping each bottle by hand in a tank of red wax.
We are about to create a disaster on the bottling line because I'm suiting up to actually dip bottles of Maker's Mark. Right now, I've got the arm cuffs on to keep the 350-degree wax off my arms, the rubber gloves, safety glasses because it's 350 degrees, and frankly, I'm an idiot. So God only knows what. There goes the apron, and Rob's going to follow me in here with the microphone. Okay, what's the tip here to doing this right?
The trick is to catch your wax so you won't get it on the bottle. Get your bottle like he is.
Okay.
Go ahead and get you one.
Okay.
Left hand on the neck, right hand on the bottom of the bottle. You'll dip into this ring.
Okay.
As you come up, make your turn and catch your wax.
Okay, so
go ahead and try it.
Dip, twist, and turn.
Dip,
okay,
twist,
here
and turn.
We go. Let's try this.
There you go. And up.
Okay. And it's going down to the cooling line. Let's try it one more time. Oops.
Too much wax.
Much wax that time. If I remember right, you guys used to have an online game where you could actually try this and try dipping wax on the website. Or allegedly, and try it and it would tell you if you screwed
up. Turn the bottle up. There you go.
Okay. And we'll try one more. I don't think I have a future in this, but... Okay. What? Okay, Rob, how did I do?
You passed. Would you like full-time employment?
No.
Now, I'm not going to take Rob up on the job offer, but if you visit the distillery, you can try your own hand at dipping. The Visitor's Center sells undipped bottles that you can dip, along with a special distillery-only bottling that's signed by master distiller Dave Pickerel and Bill Samuels, Jr. I interviewed Bill last fall in episode 117, and we'll close with a follow-up question from that interview. After the episode, I received an email from WhiskeyCast listener Craig Tom, who pointed out that Pappy Van Winkle had been making weeded bourbons at the Stitzel Weller Distillery in Frankfurt before William Samuels Sr. developed the recipe for Maker's Mark. And Craig didn't believe that Bill gave Pappy Van Winkle proper credit for that work during the interview. So I went back and asked Bill about the role Pappy Van Winkle and other distillers had in helping his father.
When Dad started out trying to create his bitter-free whiskey, he did what he always did. He reached out to his friends, and Pappy Van Winkle was one of his dear friends, as was Hap Motlow, the owner of Jack Daniels, and Lem Motlow's son, as was Jerry Beam, as was Ed Shapiro from Heaven Hill, and as was Lyons Brown from Brown-Forman. So they, you know, they all participated with him, and there's no question Pappy's influence, because I used to ride around with Dad on Saturday when he would talk to these guys. They were his advisory group, and it really is possible that Pappy had the greatest influence in telling him you got to change the formula. You can't get there through engineering. You actually have to change the formula. You have to create a new whiskey that starts farther forward in the palate if it's going to end up at the tip of the tongue. And yeah, I don't think there's any question but Pappy played a huge role. As Jerry, the Beams were our neighbors for about 85 years, and Dad and Jerry were inseparable. So I remember them spending a lot of time together. I remember Ed Shapiro, who created Heaven Hill. He was living in Bardstown at the time. I remember going to the old Fitzgerald Distillery and spending hours with Pappy back in the late 40s and early 50s when Dad was working on this. So it really was a collaborative thing. And he would, if he were to come back today, he would celebrate the impact of what he and his friends were able to accomplish for bourbon. I mean, it's really recreated all the buzz.
And I think what a lot of people don't understand when you say these guys were all friends is that if you never looked at Whiskey Row in Bardstown, they all lived within next door to each other, within feet of each other, in the same houses right along the same street.
Well, you really had three Whiskey Rows. You had Bardstown's Whiskey Row. You had 4th Street in Louisville, where a lot of the distilleries, and they did tend to congregate. And then you had a group in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Now, these were farmers in Lawrenceburg, so they didn't live in a town. But you had three areas where distillers tended to congregate, and they always tended to congregate with each other.
And they all shared tips and secrets and
everything I saw from, and I go back to, well, not the beginning of the Second World War, but I have recollections from 1944 on. People like I.W. Harper, Henry McKenna, of course, Colonel Beam, I was with him every day for about 3 years, and John Shawnee that owned Early Times. He lived across the street from us. So there was, you know, that was pretty much the group. And they did help each other. And Dad was the one that needed the help, because he was the one that was starting over. He didn't know what he was doing. Other than he had a pretty clear vision of what he was trying to accomplish, he just didn't know how to get there.
With the help of Pappy Van Winkle and the other bourbon barons, he figured it out, though. About 3,000 people are at the distillery today as I'm recording this episode for Ambassador Day. It's the final event of the Maker's Mark Thoroughbreds and Redheads weekend. That's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. Special thanks to the folks at Maker's Mark for their hospitality. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. You'll find a complete archive of past episodes, along with links, the calendar of events, and the Whiskey Cast store at the Whiskey Cast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes this time around from the bar at DeShays Restaurant and Bar in Lexington, Kentucky. Next time, I'll be back in the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.